through a very probing interview process I've done with them. People who never in their entire careers agreed to be interviewed, to have their success strategies identified, researched, analyzed, and articulated. And now I have the privilege of introducing to you Drew Allen Kaplan, the founder of DAC, D-A-K, the DAC catalog, Daconians, the man who changed the entire approach to how electronics and computer products were marketed in the United States. Drew took an idea and a passion and a genuine fascination for how products worked and how they improved and enriched the quality of someone's life or business and turned that into $1 billion worth of combined sales. In the process, he learned more about influencing people, exciting people, assuring people, compelling people, befriending people, and selling high-priced, conceptual-type products than any other man I've ever met, period. I'm proud to say that Drew has become a very dear and a highly valued friend of mine. And in the course of that friendship, I was able to persuade him to allow me to do the undoable. We sat together in a studio for 5 continuous hours. I asked him questions I promise no one else ever in the past has asked of him. I took him to levels of expression and explanation he has never, ever done before, privately or publicly. And I got him to summarize basically his entire success philosophy, his approach to advertising, to business building, to marketing, to sales letters, to selling, what he learned from his mentors, and how that applies to anyone in any type and kind of business or professional practice. This is pure nuts and bolts, total ideas and application. No philosophy, no motivation, just minute after minute of very specific, no-nonsense, exactly how to do it, answers, techniques, strategies, and breakthrough approaches that you absolutely can immediately use in your selling, your marketing, and your promotional activities. You're probably going to get 50 to 75 specific ideas in the next hour and a half. Please take out a pad and pencil and make the most comprehensive notes you have ever taken on any Wizard's Edge issue that you've ever listened to. This one is going to make you a fortune and not a small one. Get ready and enjoy.
Today our guest is a man who's a very dear friend of mine, but that's not the reason we're interviewing him. I'm interviewing him today because he is a legend in an industry which is legendary. He's probably helped introduce technology nationwide to more nooks and crannies and educate more people than any 5 people I know, and I know a lot of people in this field. He is a legend who basically took a concept in its embryonic infancy stage and turned it into one of the largest companies of its kind in the world. In the process, he's been on the cutting edge of more technological advancements for the consumer than I think I can count. In addition to that, and I'm not trying to flatter him, I think he's a brilliant entrepreneur. I think he's one of the most gifted educators I have ever met in my life. And education is the ability to explain the complex in very simple terms, and he can do that masterfully. But he's got so many other attributes that I want to focus on and talk about today that rather than build his ego any higher, let's get right to it. My guest is Drew Allen Kaplan, founder of DAC Industries, creator, originator of the famous DAC catalog, All you Daconians know what I'm talking about. And before I start, I should say, we're sitting in one of the most comfortably air-conditioned studios in all of Southern California when it's 112 degrees outside. We're sitting here shivering but having a great time. So, Drew, how are you and welcome?
Hi, Jay. Thank you very much for having me, and that's a very flattering and somewhat embarrassing introduction. What I am is a simple guy who loves electronics, has always loved electronics, has always loved cutting edge and science, and all I've tried to do is bring that hobby of mine to everyone else.
It's interesting. When I asked you to come here, you thought I was going to ask you just about copywriting and about the mail order business and about technology, when in fact I think the greatest gifts you have to share are your knowledge, your experiences, your understandings of all the aspects of business building, of being an entrepreneur, of breaking into a changing or a cutting-edge industry. So with your permission, I'm going to take you on a very broad and a very fascinating journey. We're both going to have an educational adventure of our own while we're doing this interview. As you know, I've had the good fortune of interviewing, of working with, and getting to meet a lot of entrepreneurs. One thing's been real evident to me, if you go back in time and look at their origins, many, not all, but many of them started out with little enterprises even when they were kids. They started out collecting Coke bottles or pop bottles and selling them for money and using the money to buy a bicycle, or they had a news route or a lemonade stand, or they bartered or traded, or they reconstructed things from scrap and resold them in a reconfigured manner. Did you do anything like that when you were young?
Well, Jay, the first thing that I did that was productive and profitable was laid bricks, and it happened to be at home. We lived in the mountains, and I laid over 2,000 bricks and terraced a hillside.
How old were you?
I was about 13 or 14 at the time, and no one thought it could be done. We were very fortunate. We lived next door to one of Disney's head architects, and every morning on his way to work, he'd come out and say, well, why don't you use a string to straighten that wall? But I learned how to lay bricks. I learned how to mix concrete. I learned how to
And you're 13 at this age?
13, 14. I did that one summer, and it took me 3 months, but that hillside today still exists with all the brick walls in place.
A question comes to mind. When you did that, I mean, what inspired you to want to lay 2,000 bricks?
Well, it may seem trite, but it was there. I looked at it. I looked at all this hillside of ivy, and I said to myself, this has to be changed. I wanted to change it. So I removed all the ivy. I used to pay the city trash man to take it away. There was a 5-limbed, 100-foot-high eucalyptus tree that had fallen, and the stump was there. So I bought a chainsaw and cut the stump out and then dug it out.
Had you ever used a chainsaw before?
Never. Never. Sorry, I tried that too. I had to dig a hole 6 feet around it by hand, and then I rented a chain, and when the trash truck would show up once a week, I'd hook the chain up, and the trash drivers would pull out whatever I'd cut. So I started really young, but it was high school that I really got going.
What'd you do then?
I was really lucky. As you probably guessed, I love technology. I used the money I earned laying bricks at a dollar a quarter an hour. I bought a tape recorder, which in those days was very, very new. And I made tapes of the music that I loved. My mother's a concert pianist, and I also love folk music, which is kind of an interesting combination.
Interesting combination, yeah.
Very interesting combination. Still love classical music. I was a cellist, and still love folk music. But I wanted to buy more and more tapes, and so I needed to support that habit. And I started installing 8-track car stereos.
This is when?
This was 1963, 64. I was about 16. And by the time I was 17 and I was driving, I was the pride of Beverly Hills because I spoke English. And I'd go to people's houses, and for $50, I'd install a car stereo. And so by the time I started college, UCLA, in 64, I had a real good business going installing car stereos for custom installations.
Now, what do you think drove you at that period to be that enterprising, that entrepreneurial?
I've always enjoyed taking on a project, something that looked difficult and that when you took it apart was easy or could be done. It wasn't a great master stroke. It was a matter of it was there. I wanted to do it. I never was comfortable sitting. I always loved electronics, and I used to put an electronics catalog inside my school books and read that instead of the school books. But I was always stuck on tape recording, and music. So that's how it all came together for me. When I moved into the dorm at UCLA, I had 9 tape recorders in my dorm room. and I was not a real popular person.
That's wild. So here you are, what, 17, 18
17,
years old?
17.
You're 17. In college, and you got this enterprise that's really thriving.
Thriving, yes.
Like, you have people working for you doing it?
By the time, I had three people then. After the first year, the dorm, this was Dykstra Hall at UCLA, suggested I might run my business elsewhere because too many people were showing up at the front desk buying recording tape.
That's wild.
But let me just tell you, what I was doing was I had these 9 tape recorders. Cassettes hadn't been invented yet. And I found a way to buy used recording tape from the studios. We had all these studios here in L.A. When you were recording Frank Sinatra in one of the studios and you had an 80-piece orchestra, you didn't use the same tape for outtakes. As soon as you went through one reel of tape, you'd pick up the next. So the used tape with the outtakes in it was generally thrown out. So I started buying it at roughly $1 a reel.
Was that really cheap?
Oh, yeah. Tape was $6, $7 then.
Okay.
So I'd buy it for $1 a reel, and I took it, and I used it myself, and then I took it back to the dorm, and I'd sell it for $2 a reel. So I literally started the company, DAC, the first company, with $100. I bought 100 rolls of tape, brought them back to the dorm, sold them for $200, went back and bought $200 worth of tape, sold it for $400, and by the time I was, maybe a junior, I had bought a tape factory for $20,000 that actually made tape. And that's when I moved into a warehouse where I lived for 7 years while I finished college and went on to found the company that wore my name for many years.
I want to get to the company, but I want to ask you some questions. I'm obsessed almost with learning how your mind thought, how it saw opportunity, challenge, issues, because you see life different than I do, different than a lot of people, and I want to understand what you see positively that we don't. So a question I want to ask is this. You said earlier, from the time you were 13, laying the bricks, you were always fascinated with challenges and projects that were not as hard as they seem. How did you see, most people see a project as insurmountable, as unpleasant, as so complicated and intimidating, it's not even worth trying. How do you see projects?
I tend to object to looking at things straight on the way that most people would look at them.
Tell me why.
Well, because going to things in a straight line is, A, the way everybody else does it, means that there are a lot of smart people who have tried going at things in a straight line, and if anyone can do it, why should I do it? I'm only interested in projects and products that no one else can really sell or no one else can really conquer.
Have you always been that way?
Always been that way. I mean, my happiest days are when I can take a product, and I've really enjoyed product. I don't know as much about services, but product or service that other people have failed at or said, this can't be done. And that's like throwing the red flag in front of the bull. To me, that's okay, how do we go about that? An example back into the company again is a company was making computers. It was a terrific early IBM computer, and it wasn't selling, and they weren't going to survive. And they handed it to me, and they said, well, what can you do with this? We have 2,000 of them. So I looked at it, and I said, this is really a sophisticated typewriter, which is what a computer was in those days. So I came up with a headline called Unfair Competition. And I went out and I bought a Xerox memory writer, and I bought an IBM, I think it was a wheel writer. And they were each about $1,100. And I offered this computer for $1,000. It was a word processing program that I created, very basic, that was nothing more than a typewriter, and a daisy wheel printer, for those people who remember the little spinning wheels. And I called it Unfair Competition, sold it for $1,000, used the metaphor of the two typewriters, showed the receipts of what I had paid for the typewriters, and said, well, you can go buy one of these typewriters, or you can have a computer that does everything the typewriter does, let you keep everything in memory, rewrite things, edit things, and play all the IBM software that there is. So the whole concept of coming at it from a different direction, it's not a computer, it's a sophisticated typewriter.
Did it work?
Oh, we sold, there were 3,000 of them, we sold 23,000, we kept that company in production for 2 years. But it was exciting because it was something that had already failed, and yet it was a great product. And that's something that I, as a caveat, you should only offer to anybody a great product or a great service. Don't offer junk, because it will haunt you forever. You have to have integrity with what you offer. So I can't take a bad product and make it look good. That's not what Drew Kaplan does. you know, I look at a product and I look at it as a solution rather than a product. I don't care how big it is, how what size it is, what it does. I care what it does for the individual who's reading the ad. So when I wanted to sell an intercom, I didn't just call it an intercom. I called it a Hey Martha phone. The reason is everybody can identify with, Hey Martha, come to the phone. So it's a combination of a phone and an intercom. When I wanted to sell a pulse watch doesn't have the same sort of appeal as a wrist EKG. So it's not just a good name, but it's putting it in a different venue. It's putting it so that people think of the result, think of the quality, think of what it's going to do for them. So another really good example might be, I had a camcorder. It was one of the first camcorders made, a really neat product. Nobody knew what it was. Did I call it a camcorder? No. I called it Daddy's Pride and Joy. Why did I call it that? Because I had surveyed people as to why they'd want camcorders. Most of them wanted to record their children. That's the main reason people bought camcorders, that and weddings. So what I did is I told the story about my younger son who was making a speech at school, and I had to be away on a business trip. So I called it Daddy's Pride and Joy. I sent my wife with a camcorder. She recorded it, and I got to see my son, and I told the whole story and sold 20,000 camcorders. So that was in the days when there were no camcorders, so I would have really missed seeing my son. And when I sold a tape deck that had no hiss, it had a certain noise reduction system, I called it the Stealth Bomber Update. So I attacked the reason. I went after the reason that it would be good for people, and I came up with a new name, a new concept for the product so that they'd understand it. And that's really what I do. I mean, even the first product that I carried, the used magnetic tape, I called it studio recording tape, the tape that Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, Sammy Davis recorded on. If you call it used, then nobody would have been interested. But associating it with leading names like that made it really exciting. It made it a better than new product. That's what lateral thinking brings to advertising and what it brings to problem solving. You don't go in a direct straight line. Any smart person can do that. The creative mind tends to attack things from the side, and it's easy to do. You just stop looking in a straight direction and think about it and say, well, how else can I think about this? What are the other alternatives? And when you do that, you find a whole multitude of ways to look at products and services and make them exciting for your potential customers.
Drew, can you give me a little formula that might be useful for anybody in any kind of business or profession to develop this kind of a mindset?
Sure. It's actually really easy. Here's an idea. Write down 10 words that are totally unrelated, like brick, like music stand, like cello, I'm a cellist, like tall, and then put your product or your concept or your service or whatever it is you're going to do next to them. And then write a sentence using your product, your service, your idea with each of those 10 words. And you know what? You're thinking laterally already. It's just that simple.
That's fascinating. When you looked at an electronic or a computer piece of equipment, can you sort of go through what your mind would do? You'd look at, for example, I'm looking at some of your lateral, what's smart sound detonator?
Smart Sound Detonator is one of my favorite products. It was an equalizer that made your stereo system sound 5-10 times better than it sounded before you put this in the system.
But most people wouldn't even know what an equalizer was, would they?
Well, they didn't know before I sold them 170,000 of them. What it is, very simple, if you have a tape deck, you put it in the tape loop of your stereo system, and then instead of having one volume control and a bass and treble control, you have 10 to 12 volume controls for each channel, and each of those volume controls one segment of the frequency spectrum, like 20 hertz and 60 hertz and 400 hertz, hertz being cycles per second. So your string bass, which is down around 60 hertz, you slide that volume control up, and all of a sudden the bass just resonates through your room. You slide the 16,000 cycle slider up, and your cymbals crash into the room. So what it does is it gives you instant control of the sound, so you get it just the way you want it. I learned that in the recording studios when I was a kid. Consumers didn't know about it when I started selling equalizers. It was terrific.
But you educated me, right?
right. Okay. What I did is, I not so much educated as shared something that I knew, was fortunate enough to learn in my past, and apply to a new product. And that's what I do with a stereo, with a computer. A computer's full of chips. You look at the computer. In the early days, you could show a picture of all the chips, and everybody would be impressed, and you'd say, oh, this is powerful. Today, and over the even the last few years, people want to know is, what will it do for me? And so a computer isn't a thing. People say that they're using an IBM or they're using an Apple Macintosh. That doesn't matter. What matters is, what program, what is the particular program you're running on that computer do for you? Is it word processing? Is it graphics? Is it sound? All of these things are available to you, and people get hung up on the mechanical parts of it's this fast or it's this big or it's that. That has nothing to do with the actual motivations behind why people buy, and that's true whether it's in mail order, whether it's in person, whether it's on the telephone. All of these things hold together, and lateral thinking and explanation and education, they all tie together.
Now, there's something that's got to be evident, because it's really evident to me. When you talk, you don't talk without inflection. You talk with such passion emanating out of every pore of your being. How do you become passionate about your product, about your service, about what it does for other people, about looking at it in this CAT scan perspective?
I think you look at your product, you learn about your product, you fall in love with your product.
Drew, you're on a little bit of sacred ground here for me, because I'm on record as teaching and advocating that you should fall in love with your customer or client, not your product or service. And there seems to be a little bit of an incongruity. Can you help clarify or tie it together? Or if you can, you can refute me, whichever is – I just want to get your perspective on it.
Oh, well, Jay, I agree with you 100%. When I fall in love with a product, I don't mean that I fall in love with the physical product. I fall in love with what it's going to do for the end user, for the customer, not what the product is unto itself.
So how it's going to enrich, enhance, protect, expand, help me in my life, make it better, richer, more prosperous, whatever.
And save you time, which, of course, is my main
critique.
I believe that saving time is the best thing that I can do for my customers, or one of the best things. That's why I'm here.
That's great. It reminds me, I'll go shopping frequently and see a dress. And I'll fall in love with that dress because of the vision of how attractive it will make my wife look, or how happy it will make her feel. Are we saying the same thing?
Exactly. That's what a product is all about. It isn't a thing unto itself. It is what it means, in this case, to your wife.
Great point. We're harmonious. Let's move on.
Okay.
Okay, but before we move on, give me a summary. Lateral thinking. What would you tell anybody in any field of endeavor about how and why lateral thinking should be a critical part of what they do every day?
I tell people to look at things sideways. First, approach it head on. How would you normally do it? Then, come up with 6 or 8 other solutions to the problem of explaining it to your customer, to educating your customer, to helping your customer or your client. And when you do that, you'll find that you start thinking laterally all the time. And most of the time, you're going to find that lateral thinking helps you do a better job, provide better service, and make your customers happier people.
But I suspect it'll also make the process of your business or your practice a lot more fun, won't it?
Oh, sure. It's been fun. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I love every minute of it. So, yes, lateral thinking gives you new ways, new creative ideas, and it keeps you going. It keeps you excited all the time.
That's great. You're leading me and setting me up for the kind of questions I really want the answers to. So I'm going to ask you another one. Taking you on your career, and I'm almost on the precipice probably of DAC, but I want to get there yet. I want to know about your attitude on selling, on helping people, customers, if you will, seize the benefit for themselves, not just the enrichment to you, of a product or service. Before you started DAC, you were selling tapes. You were manufacturing tapes. How'd you sell them? And why? And what was your motivation?
Well, actually, tapes were number 2. First was the 8-track car stereos.
Okay.
First of all, I was installing them. And I worked for a stereo store in Beverly Hills called the Sound Center. The owner was a friend of mine. As would be expected when you're 17 and 18 and you have friends who are in electronics, what do? You hang out at the neighborhood stereo store.
Sure.
That's what I did. When I was in high school, on the same corner as the school, there was a store called the Hi-Fi Corner, and we all used to congregate there. There was a small group of us that would, I guess, today be called nerds, because we all loved stereo and electronics. And stereo was just coming in. Right then, it was still Hi-Fi,
yes, sure.
Monaural. But it was a really exciting time. And as each new product has come out, I've been able to put my hands on it, play with it, and then it's always been fun for me to explain to other people what made it work. And that's, I think, where I come in and where what I do is a little different, or what I've always done is a little different. Whether I was installing an 8-track car stereo and then I was the first Learjet, remember the airplane people?
Sure.
I guess they're still around, but they also introduced the first 8-track car stereo that had a special motor called a Pabst motor. Boy, you're taking me back a long way. But this motor had a very heavy flywheel that spun on the outside rather than a belt that caused flutter and wow, meaning a waving sound in your car.
What was the advantage?
The advantage was that you had better, smoother music, and it didn't go when you hit a stop or when you moved. And this was a far better system.
Breakthrough.
It was literally a breakthrough. And I became the first dealer in Los Angeles. So not only was I installing for people, I started selling. And I started advertising and where? The Daily Bruin. I was at UCLA, I was a student, so it was the beginning of, if you're like me, if you love stereo, if you want to hear
your music.
Is that
how you wrote them?
Yeah.
What was your advertising philosophy, and what was your motivation when you were writing ads as a college student in the Bruin?
Well, why I wrote them was because I had this great product that no one else had, and that I could make money and support my habit and buy more and more tape recorders and live a lifestyle that was more in keeping with the way that I wanted to live. And by the way, I had no problems. My parents wanted to pay for my college education, but by the second year it became sort of, you know, not important because I started at UCLA in September of 64, and by October I was self-sufficient. So it was a lot of luck and a lot of good fun, and I enjoyed every minute of it.
So you're installing. You're now a dealer. So take me to the tape. I want to know about your method of selling, of persuading, of connecting with your customers. How'd you do it?
Okay. Well, it was easy because I loved electronics. I tended to hang around with other people who love electronics. And as an example, before, when I was very young, I actually had my door open and closed to my bedroom when I was 10 or 12 automatically. There was no stereo in those days, but I had 9 speakers in my room, and I had remote control of my drapes. And I think I was about 10 or 11 when I almost burned the house down using used wire that I had soldered in about 10 different places. So my love of electronics started very, very young.
And did your parents nurture that?
They nurtured it. They weren't into electronics themselves, but they were into allowing me to pursue my interests. As long as I was headed in the right direction, which was college, I could do pretty much anything I wanted to do. So they nurtured it, they supported me, and I had extremely supportive, very intelligent parents. So when I looked at my own needs as an owner of 9 tape decks, knowing what I needed in the way of tape, in the way of equipment, it was real easy for me to recommend to other people in the dorm, which was the first stage. Stage 1, all the people on my floor, 5th floor, Dykstra Hall. The second stage was to expand beyond that to the rest of the dorm, verbally telling people. I became pretty much the dorm expert.
Well, give me your presentation in a summarized minute.
It was, here is the best tape you can use. It's the same tape that all of the professionals use. This isn't tape from a hi-fi store that may or may not be good. This is the same tape that people like Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis were all using. I had their voices on these tapes. It was really exciting to listen to these tapes. They were quarter-inch and half-inch tapes running at 15 inches per second, and I had the recorders to play them. Then I would erase those tapes and wind them to 7-inch reels, which was the size most people could use. So I was offering people at UCLA in the dorm the best tape that money could buy, the same tape the professionals used, and I was offering the very best tape that money could buy, not at $6 or $8, but at $2 a reel.
So the precedent was set.
The precedent was set. It was the best tape, bar none, and it was at a price that was a third of what they could buy any tape for in a hi-fi store. So there was both the price, there was this is the tape that Sammy Davis used, and this is the best tape coming from Drew, who is really the nut with the 9 tape decks. And then I started running ads in the Daily Bruin that said studio recording tape, you know, use the tape of the professionals. And I had some of those ads. I was looking at them a couple of months ago. And the whole concept was use the same tape. Don't use inferior tape, because there was cheap tape around, just like they're cheap cars, they're cheap everything. This was the best tape that could be bought. This is the tape the professionals chose, and I was offering it at a great price. So you had the concept of professional, and you had the benefit of cheap price, which, of course, for college students, very important. And that business continued to grow until I ran out of used tape. The studios weren't producing enough tape to support how much I was selling. So then I went to the government, and I found out that there were great reams of government surplus tape. At that time, they were using tape for all the space shots. Those were the days in the 60s and early 70s when we had a very active space program. And most of it came from Fort George Meade in outside Washington, D.C. And I found a way to negotiate with the government through bid that no one else knew what to do with the tape, and I used to buy truckloads. At one point, I was buying 40-foot truckloads, 8, 10, 12 truckloads at a time.
Hey, how old now, 21?
I was, 19, okay. 20. I moved from the dorm to an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment, grew out of that, moved to a four-bedroom house, grew out of that, moved into a 3,000-square-foot warehouse. I was in the 3,000.
You were living there, too.
I was living in the warehouse. By the time I had an indoor hot pool, I had an indoor sauna, I was very comfortable. I had palm trees. I was great. I was baking bread. I was doing all sorts of neat stuff in my warehouse, having a wonderful time still going to college. And I was able to bid on what they called government surplus tape. And then I had enough tape, because then I could buy all the tape I wanted, and we were bringing in 40-foot truckloads of tape, 8, 10 at a time. A 40-footer also coincidentally holds 40,000 pounds of tape. It's a lot of tape. And so I started selling that tape as still used recording tape, and I was selling all of that I could make. And slit, and at that point I bought a tape factory and started making tapes, and that's about when cassettes hit, and I started making cassette tapes.
And how old are you now?
By this time I was 20, 21.
Had you graduated?
No, I actually spent 5 years at UCLA and actually never graduated. I have one class left, statistics, to take.
That's funny. Okay, so you're in the tape business,
right.
Manufacturing cassette tapes.
Cassettes, open reel, and videotapes, all three.
Okay. And videotapes back then was a much different market than today.
It was a much different market. There were no cassettes. They were actually 7-inch and 10-inch reels of tape, half-inch wide. I had 200 people at that point working for me, slitting this used tape and manufacturing new tape. So I was a tape manufacturer, the same as Scotch or Ampex. They were my competitors. And we were one of the few people that actually manufactured tape. We coated it. We bought the Mylar from DuPont. We bought chemicals from the various chemical companies, had 9,000 gallons underground tanks, had ball mills, mixed all of the oxides, coated the tape.
I got to stop you. I got to stop and ask a question. Here you're a young man figuring out how to do all these rather complex functions, relatively technical, competing with very large multinational companies. First of all, what gave you the confidence to do it in the first place? Number two, how did you figure out how to put it all together, and what was your selling proposition to your customers?
Basically, the concept was no one told me I couldn't do it.
Interesting.
And it's a very trite phrase, but if somebody tells you you can't do it, you tend to be afraid to try it. If nobody tells you you can't do it, and you try it, it works. And so my first tape was not very successful, but by the second, the third, the fourth, or the fifth time, I was making very good tape. And so our tape was comparable to any of the major brands. In fact, I had many state contracts. I was selling by mail, obviously, and let me step back for a moment. How did I sell all this tape, not just at UCLA? Remember I said my friends were tape nuts.
Yes.
One of them was service manager for a company called Concertone, which was the early TEAC, which is a major electronics company. Another one was Ure, U-H-E-R, a German tape recorder company. I happened to have terrible handwriting, so I became a very good typist. I took all their warranty cards, and I typed the names and addresses from all of the warranty cards that had come in from these various tape deck manufacturers and created a mailing list, not knowing anything about mail order.
Just intuitive.
Intuitive. I don't know that intuitive is even fair. I'm not sure it was that good. I knew the people. I had the warranty cards. I said, why don't I send something to these people? And so in 1965, 66, I was already mailing things. And I had my own string tire. I did bulk rate by myself. I just sat down.
And string tire for...
I'm sorry. When you mail something bulk rate, you have to put 10 pieces to a zip code together and tie them up with string. And then you put them in a trailer, which I rented, hooked them to the back of my station
You're
wagon, and drove them down to the terminal annex downtown Los Angeles.
Now stop. I got to know this question. Something in your being... It's got incredible ambition, incredible resourcefulness, and incredible focus. What do you think that is? What happened?
Well, I was very fortunate. I'm not a first-generation immigrant. My parents were, and they taught me a work ethic. And they espoused a work ethic, and they lived by a work ethic.
Can you summarize what that ethic is?
Ethic is work hard, save, do well, help people, and you will do well yourself. And my parents have always contributed to the community. And I think it's very important that you do something with the community and that you work hard. And I can't. I've tried. I have two children of my own that I've tried to instill this work ethic. And I think we've been successful. Of course, it's up to them. But you either have a work ethic or you don't. I don't know how to tell anybody how to work. I know how to tell you how to work smarter, faster, easier. That's what the beauty of technology is. But you have to want to do it. That's the only thing that you have to have within yourself.
I suspect that it's a misnomer. I don't think work to you is drudgery. I don't think work to you is anything but a sheer joy. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. I love creating. I don't mind looking something up in the dictionary or the encyclopedia. I will look and do research for fun because I'm interested. I mean, I read an article yesterday in Discover Magazine on Easter Island. I've always been fascinated by Easter Island. Somebody just did a complete dissertation on what happened at Easter Island, but I took an hour and read the article. I've always read everything I can get my hands on, and I think that one of the things when I just said that people have to have that inner drive themselves, that's sort of unfair. If you know you can do it, that drive tends to generate itself. If you don't know how to go about accomplishing something or you're afraid to do it, the drive stays dormant. I know that if I don't have right now a computer next to me, I don't tend to write. But if there's a computer right there and something that I can see finishing, I'll write, I'll create. I just can't contain myself. I want to get more out. But if there's nothing, if there's no end in sight, if there's no goal that's obtainable, I'll sit around and clean up my desk for 2 weeks without accomplishing anything.
So what's the lesson?
Deadlines. Deadlines are wonderful things.
Do you impose them on yourself?
I impose them on myself. I say, I've got to finish this by tomorrow. And it may be 2, 3, 4 in the morning that I'll keep going just because I want to finish it rather than leave it until tomorrow. Because if you don't set a deadline, you never finish anything. And that's just a bit of self-discipline that once you start doing, you'll find it makes life much, much easier.
Okay, now it's time. I got to get you forward because I'm getting excited. I'm getting really excited. So we got you in this 3,000-square-foot warehouse.
$300 a month rent, which I was really nervous about because it seemed like a lot of money in those days.
But something tells me you had a surplus and the capacity to pay it comfortably.
No problem.
Okay, so let's get to the big event. So how did this glint in your eye turn into reality? Let's talk about the concept, the inspiration, the formation, the whole emerging sort of genesis of DAC.
Well, the whole concept, it already was DAC, but at that time, I was in my fifth year of UCLA studying psychology, loving psychology, by the way. But I realized, and I was very fortunate at a young age, to be able to say, I want to do what I love doing. And that's something I think everybody should strive to do. Because if you're unhappy at your job, you're unhappy in your marriage, you're unhappy in your life, you're not going to accomplish anything. So I had to make a really tough decision, and this was during my fifth year, that said, am I going to become a psychiatrist, which is the way that I had been heading, which I think I would have been happy, or am I going to pursue this technology that I love, that I seem to never be able to get enough of? Even today, 35 years later, every time I get near something new, I can't keep my hands off it. I'm out, I buy it, I play with it, I explore it. I go over to the Orient and I play with it and invent it. I love this. And so I was very fortunate at a young age to say, I can always go back. Let me give this a shot for a few years and see what happens. And that really, I would say, was more the genesis of DAC, was the ability to say, what if I get to lose? If it doesn't work out, I withdrew gracefully with good grades, I can go back.
But you went into it with full, unbridled passion, didn't you?
Oh, I started that in 64. It was unbridled passion.
But you and I both know, because we've had the bad fortune of seeing a lot of people who play act at business as they do at life with no passion or a very low level of passion.
Well, a lot of these people went into business, went into work, went into life to make money.
As opposed to
going into it with passion, with love for accomplishing something, for building something, for inventing something. I believe that if you do what you love doing, the money will follow. You'll have enough money to do the things you want to do. And often, you may have a goal that is earning more money because you're so miserable at what you're doing. That's a terrible way to run your life, is to be waiting for weekends or 2 weeks off at vacation. You should love what you do. When you get up in the morning, you should be enthused.
Now, do you like Monday mornings?
I don't like Monday mornings because the phone starts ringing. Other than the phone, I love Monday mornings, but I don't have a problem because I work 7 days a week.
I was going to say, you and I are
not. It doesn't make any difference.
But it's not work.
The only difference for Monday morning is that everybody else comes in and they call you with whatever they didn't finish the previous week. So I don't love Monday mornings, but it isn't because of going to work. It's I work Sundays. I still am putting in 8, 10, 12 hours a day of, some would call it work. But it is working with things that I love doing. And no one, don't get me wrong, you will never love every minute of what you do. But if the overall thrust of the day is powerful, is potent, and you feel you've accomplished something at the end of the day, the 2 or 3 hours of perhaps negotiating or doing something with someone you don't want to do it with, that fades away. You concentrate on the good parts. And it is a wonderful way to live one's life, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
And I can tell by your eyes, you're sparkling. But we got to get to DAC as a catalog company. So here DAC, the tape company, is rolling barely along. And what year is it?
Okay. Let me fade for just a minute, and then I promise we'll move forward.
Okay.
In 64, 65, my first catalog, which went out to the first tape people, its headline, its byline, its logo said, importing and exporting of products, closeouts, introduction of new products. It was prophetic. I don't know where I came up with the 3 or 4 things that were part of what I considered the logo, but they were there. It ended up in DAC being importing and exporting of products. It ended up introducing new products, and it ended up doing closeouts. And the fourth was mail order. And it ended up being a mail order company entirely. I loved all of those things. So as the original genesis really never dramatically changed. It was what I liked to do, and it was the way it evolved. So DAC, the catalog of electronics that everyone's familiar with, really had its genesis in the early 80s, 79 to 80. And that's already 10 years into a company that was doing millions of dollars. What happened was an event changed my life.
What was the event?
The event was very simple. It was a man. His name is Joe Sugarman.
I know Joe.
Probably the greatest copywriter, really the greatest promoter, and a great gentleman, real good friend of mine. I went to one of his seminars.
Now, I got
to
stop. Joe Sugarman had a company, he still does, but he had a company, JS&A, that in the early 70s,
through 79 or 80,
was like an icon for selling high-tech, low-priced, modestly priced, breakthrough consumer products.
Not necessarily low-priced.
as I said, high price, consumer price. I'm easy.
Great product.
But I remember him, just for clarification, he had the same gift, or you and he were kindred spirits on opposite sides of the country. I remember one of his classic successes. He looked at a little walkie-talkie set, and he said, you know what that is? That's a pocket CB, didn't he?
Absolute classic, Joe.
And he recharacterized it, and what did he sell? Something like $20 million worth?
At least. And it was a fabulous concept of taking a walkie-talkie, which he did the same sort of thing that I do. What he did is he looked at that, and he went to the manufacturer and said, explain it to me. And they explained, well, it's this, and it's a walkie-talkie, and it's this, and it broadcasts on this CB frequency number 14. He said, CB frequency 14. He said, yes, all walkie-talkies are on CB frequency 14.
This is back when CBs were really hot and you couldn't get them. You couldn't buy them if you wanted to.
Right. So Joe came up with Pocket CB. It's a perfect example of taking a product and showing, again, his sort of view of it is lateral as well. Looking at it, instead of it being a walkie-talkie, he made it a Pocket CB. And he sold more than he could ever deliver, as usual.
And he sold numbers of products like that. Now, at this time, I happen to know, because I was operating in the mail order business back then, that he got the desire, and I don't think it could have been profit motivated because he didn't sell it for that much, but he got the desire to start offering to a select group of people. Was it a weekend or a week?
It was a week, 5 days for $2,000.
Which is nominal.
You could go and listen to Joe explain the concepts behind how he created advertisements and marketing.
And tell me, so just as another clarification, it's the year 1978,
9? 9 or 80, okay. In that range.
Joe Sugarman, the classic, most successful at that point, consumer electronics mail order retailer, is offering a select group of people the chance to come to his mansion in, was it Wisconsin?
Wisconsin, yes. One in Wisconsin, he also had one in Hawaii.
He offers to train a handful of people for a real nominal amount, because he must have been making millions of dollars.
He was making a lot.
It wasn't the money.
It was the concept of working together and the feedback.
So, Drew, what did you get out of that seminar? You attended what? Four times?
I attended the seminar four times. I must be a slow learner. The first time was exciting. The second time was really great. But life's experience helps a lot, because the first time I hadn't written that kind of advertising. The second time I had. By the third and fourth times, I was busy writing hundreds of ads, and each time my enthusiasm would be raised to such fever levels. I came home ecstatic, ready to write. But I want you to know that Joe Sugarman's seminars changed my life, and he changed the life of a lot of other people who attended his seminar. And I learned a lot. It was the seminal difference between normal writing, and what he unleashed with me was the ability to write ads like illegitimate child for a headset, the can you be bribed ad I wrote after that seminar. Joe was the most important single individual in forming the kind of advertising that I write, and he really unleashed this kind of concept in my head.
Without breaching proprietary or intellectual property, because I know that he still occasionally considers doing that, and it's a legendary program, and back then it was very expensive, and today it probably, for the value, would be real inexpensive, but can you share what you think were the embodying traits that he taught you that no one else at that point, and perhaps no one else even today, understood?
Well, let me share something that I think is really important. I've been to a lot of seminars. I've read a lot of books. One, Joe Sugarman has done it. Joe wrote ads. He created products. He did it. So when he came to a seminar to tell us what he did and to interact with us, he was able to do it in the real form. He was a real businessman, not a teacher that had never done it. And what he was able to do was to impart his wisdom, his knowledge, his experience to people at all levels of sales and marketing. The experience was really terrific. He taught nuts and bolts, and he taught concepts. And that made the seminar really worthwhile. Not once, not twice, not three times, but 10 times if he had kept giving the seminars.
I want to get you on a tangent for just a minute so you can help me and help our listener. Joe Sugarman doesn't regularly give those seminars anymore. How can I or how can our listener get the same kind of a real-world hands-on experiential-based learning process, what do you think the closest comparable alternative to participating in a Joe Sugarman seminar might be today?
Well, you know, maybe Joe will do some more seminars, and I'll tell you, I'll be number one on the list. Two, I'm thinking of doing some seminars and some tapes on the nuts and bolts of marketing.
I would encourage that. I think that'd be a great gift to the whole world, and certainly to every business owner or prospective one.
Well, thank you very much. I think that what I've done is really exciting. I've had a good time doing it, and I understand it. One of the reasons that Joe gave the seminars and the reason that I'm thinking of doing it is it helps you codify your ideas. Joe got a lot out of the seminars, as do the students, because Joe was able to codify his ideas that he had used subliminally over time. When you give a seminar, you have to be able to elucidate. You have to be able to clarify. You have to be able to make those ideas really clear for people listening to you. Often, we write, we create, and we don't know why we do it. We start with a blank piece of paper, and when we're done, we have a really creative ad. A painter has a great painting, but most of us don't really know what it is that we went through to get there. Let me give you an example. A couple of years ago, I was trying to teach some writers how I write, and they said, you know, Drew, you write in triads. And I said, gee, what's a triad? And they said, well, true, it's a group of three consecutive ideas that tie together and that makes a really powerful mental impression. I said, gee, I hadn't noticed. So I looked through my catalogs, and lo and behold, virtually every ad was loaded with triads. I mean, I looked at a phone ad. It says, it's smart, it's tough, it's fast. I mean, that was the way that I wrote about an automated phone. I had another, a temperature controller that says, check the temperatures of anything from your jacuzzi to your aquarium to your attic. You had a security system that said you can watch for pilferage, shoplifting, or accidents. Let me kind of give you an idea of how I would use a triad in a paragraph, and it's sort of the style that I write. This was an ad for an answering machine. But before we explore just how easy it is to use, and all of its sophisticated features such as toll saver, two-way record, and remote erasing of messages, let's take a look at the phone. Well, you see the triad in there? That kept them going, and it kept them interested for what was coming later. And then I said, but let's stop for a minute and look at the phone. So that's another writing technique, but the triad is so strong that it kept them reading because they wanted to find out about those three things that I'm going to tell them later in the ad.
So if you follow through, which I encourage you, and I'll be one of the first to attend your program, and you do that, that's great. But if you don't, or if it takes you a year or two, what do I do if I live in New York or Pennsylvania and I want to get exposure to someone who's done it, someone who understands business? Is there some way maybe you can go in your neighborhood? Did you ever go and intern or just basically network with anybody in your field, in your industry when you were running DAC?
You know, Jay, I wish I could have networked because I had to reinvent the wheel and do things that I thought that were original. It turned out, you know, I recently read a book I should have read years ago, a book by Claude Hopkins. And Claude Hopkins was, I think, 1930, one of the great advertising men. Just a fabulous guy. And I had never read his book. And I read his book, and in his book, he tells a story about a department store that was just about facing bankruptcy. And it had a set of old Mackinaws, that tells you how old it is, range slickers, that weren't very good. They were really cheap, and they weren't selling. So they went to an advertising man, Claude Hopkins, and they said, could you write an ad? Because we got to move these or we're going to file bankruptcy next week. And so Claude Hopkins wrote an ad that said, you know, we've got some really second-class Mackinaws. They're not good, but they're not really terrible either. But for 2 cents each, they're a really good buy, and you're going to love it. And so Claude ran the ad. And before the ad appeared, the president of the department store called him and screamed at him and said, how dare you do that? You'll put us out of business. We have absolutely no chance. By 10 o'clock in the morning, every one of the Mackinaws was sold. The store was saved. That's the true story. That's what happens when you tell people what's wrong with something, and that's the kind of thing that I've done throughout my advertising career. Had I read the book earlier, I would have known that. I wouldn't have had to learn that myself.
So, one more time. Sooner you get your seminars or your tapes or your books together, great. But until that time, I'm a dentist, in Ohio, or I'm a contractor in Philadelphia. What do you think might be the most intelligent and viable approach I could take to get the equivalent of your Joe Sugarman?
Well, I think what you should do is look around the city you're in, because it's the easiest and what you can do the fastest, and find the people who are the most successful at doing what you want to do, and go to them and meet them, and try and understand what they're doing, and spend time with them, maybe intern with them. You know, it's only time. If you're willing to spend some time and help them, you'll learn what they know, and then you'll carry that knowledge with you for the rest of your life. So I strongly recommend that you spend the time to go and meet the people that you respect and follow them. And that will lead you on the road to future success. It really isn't difficult. All you need to do is pick up the telephone, make a few calls, and you get into these people. Smart people generally aren't threatened by teaching other people. It's the mediocre people that are threatened by teaching you, and you don't want to be mediocre. And therefore, the people that you seek out will probably be willing to talk to you.
I think in confirmation of that, Drew, is the fact that when Joe Sugarman did his seminars and charged a lot then, $2,000, what did he limit it to, 20 people?
12 people.
Yeah, so he made a whopping $24,000, which sounds like a lot, but at the time his business was earning him millions. I know he didn't do it for the money. He did it for two reasons. People who are really skilled love to teach, and they also love to learn in the process. And as you say, the more you ask someone to explain how and why they do something, the clearer it becomes to them. So it's a dual growth. So I think everyone here would be very benefited by following that recommendation. Why do you think, though, that some people like yourself are willing to seek out other experts, colleagues, kindred spirits, mentors, people who can train, can direct, can nurture, liberate their energy, their ambition, their resourcefulness, their passion? And many people don't have the wherewithal, even if it doesn't cost, because there's no – I mean, I remember myself, when I was young, I worked all night for 1 year at a job so that all day long I could go sit out and hang out in the offices and pick the minds of successful business owners in Indianapolis where I was raised. People thought I was crazy. No one would do anything like that, but it taught me so much. It sounds like you were willing to spend a relatively substantial amount of money and travel a relatively large number of miles to gain access to somebody else's expertise.
It's an apprenticeship, and Jay, you should understand that, because thousands of people pay you tens of thousands of dollars to attend your seminars, and they come away from those seminars, because I've met a few of them, very, very enthused and with a better understanding of how to change their lives. So I think that I'm not the only person in the world that came out of Joe's seminar or your seminar fully charged and ready to go. Every time you listen, you can go 10, 20, 30 times, and each time you'll pick up one more thing or 10 more things. It's really exciting.
People don't realize, and again, I don't want to get too far afield, but there are experts and mentors that I've been impacted by at a very, very, very high level who I've gone back to their well, either in written form, audio form, and whenever I've had the opportunity in the live form, dozens of times, and they may say the same thing to me over and over again, but I hear it with greater clarity. I see nuances. I see depth. I see connectivity, and I sense that's what happened to you.
Well, it's life's experience. I mean, they often say education's wasted on the young, and youth is, but when you have already been in business, when you've written 1,000 ads, and then you hear someone talk about advertising, you know where the chaff is and how to separate it from the wheat.
Turn the tape over now for more of the program on Side 2. Welcome to another edition of The Wizard's Edge with the wizard himself, Jay Abraham, marketing genius known around the world for his insights into marketing. Jay, a few programs back, we mentioned something about a process that you've developed called a template planning process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're going to expand on that today. Is this true?
It is true.
Do we want to talk about how this originated with you before we get into it?
Yeah, sure. Basically, it's a progression, Marty. I have a history of continuously precipitating or producing all these incredible successes profit boosts, sales increases for businesses of all kinds, and I never really stopped to think of how I did it. Then when I started doing private training programs for large groups and they were paying me $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, some people paid me $7,500 and a quarter just for a day of my time for their company, I had to be relatively finite, relatively pragmatic, relatively strategic in the way I explained and taught my principles. And because I've charged so very much money, it couldn't just be rah-rah inspired motivation. It had to be meat and potatoes and explanations that anybody could easily take to the bank. In other words, anyone could use very immediately and very easily and very applicably in their individual and unique business or professional situation. So over the years, I became more and more refined, and I basically was able to explain it in a systematic approach where basically I could teach people exactly how to look at their business, look at their circumstances, ask a lot of questions, fill in the evident blanks, and when all the dust settled, they would have answers on exactly what they should be using and what they should be doing. And it sort of has progressed, and I'll go through it with you now. It's in various components, and so I'll just basically share it with you, Marty, and we'll see where it goes.
All right, let's hear. I guess I'm kind of excited about this because it seems to me it's a technical way to maybe absorb some of your expertise.
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
Okay.
So now I'm taking a presumption, or at least I'm presupposing that everyone I'm talking to has been through the bulk of the issues and the tapes of the Wizard's Edge program. So they have a working understanding of my philosophies, my principles, my specific strategies and actions. If anything, they probably have too many instead of not enough ideas, and they don't know where to begin, and they don't know what's most applicable, and maybe they're struggling with a few questions. Maybe they can't really plow through it all and figure out what to do. Maybe they don't see a way to use the ideas or the techniques in their own specific business. Maybe it all seems either too abstract or too redundant. And maybe it's just too dense. So what I want to do is just go through and try to demystify it and simplify it, okay?
Okay.
First thing we have to do is know what in the world you're trying to get to. What is the end result you are trying to achieve? Most people say, oh, I want to grow my business. Well, that's not acceptable. Tell me first and foremost, take a piece of paper and write down what exactly you're trying to get to, what you want it to look like. And by that I mean, do you want the business to double or triple? And if so, are you prepared operationally, financially, mentally to grow it in conventional ways? By that I mean, if your business right now does $1 million and that's being done by 1,000 customers, and that means on average each customer is worth $1,000 a year in sales to you, and you want to double your business, if you don't do anything else but just add customers, you're going to need 2,000 customers. If you add 2,000 customers, can your current sales force accommodate them? Can your current facility accommodate them? Can your current inventory satisfy them? Can your current equipment and delivery system accommodate that? Or will you have to invest massively in expanded? Well, you got to ask yourself these questions because a lot of people have no vision of where they're really trying to get, and if they're unlucky enough to get where they think they want to be, the cost both in management, capital, time, emotion is atrocious. As I've taught you over the months, there are a number of optional ways to get where you're trying to go. You can do it by getting more yield out of every sale, getting more sales out of every customer, or just adding more customers, or having other people sell your products for you, or any combination therein. Each different combination either accelerates, simplifies, and leverages up or down the process, but you can't even begin until you know for yourself what it is you're trying to get to, and you have reconciled yourself to what the implications of achieving that tangible goal are. Are you with me, Marty?
I sure am.
Okay, so the first thing you got to do is know what you want it to look like and whether that picture is really what you're trying to accomplish or whether the implications and the requirements of achieving that picture are as exciting and appropriate as you imagine or whether it causes a lot of different problems. Okay, so once you know what you're trying to do, then you got to look at your current business as it exists today. You're going to go through all the models. I think I taught in one of the tapes the concept of the diving board and the Parthenon, didn't we?
Yeah, you touched upon that.
You'll remember that the diving board is what most companies look like. It's companies whose whole business foundation is being supported by reliance on one primary approach to growing and sustaining customers, one method of selling or of generating business. You got to ask yourself, right this moment, how is your foundation of business being supported and driven? And by that I mean, is there one pillar? Are there seven pillars? What are they, and how are they working? Because you got to know that first, okay?
Okay.
So, I mean, how is your business being built? You got to write all this down because you got to know these things. The next thing you have to ask yourself is, how many more ways am I comfortable in expanding? My optimum model, my theoretical model, if I had myself and all my clients operating at the fullest level of potential, everybody would have a fully structured Parthenon. It might have 8 to 10 primary revenue or multiple sources of income, of sales, of customers or clients. And underneath each one, you would have sub-Parthenons. In other words, if you were doing direct selling, you might have 7 different modes of direct selling you were doing at the same time. If you had joint ventures, you might have 10 wholly different approaches to joint ventures. If you had referral systems as one of your pillars, you might have 5 different referral systems operating always at the same time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. If a person doesn't know what they're doing, they could get lost in that, however. True.
Well, but we're going to start. But we've got to figure out where you are right now, because most of you are going to be at 1 or 2.
Okay, okay.
And most of you aren't going to be at the ones that you're really you're going to give you the maximum yield. So you want to basically figure out where you are, and you want to know how many additional ways you can leverage. You want to figure out where your highest and best leverage or multiplication factors exist. In most of your situations, it will probably be to increase the size of the sale and the frequency or additional ways you can get more revenue in the future from an existing or past customer or client. In few cases, it'll be just to bring on new customers, but it's highly unlikely that most of you are going to do this from the point of just adding customers. You got to go back for a minute and review and recognize my concept of optimization, because it's the focal key to this whole template working. You got to realize that there are a number of ways to grow any organization, but that most people want to do it in a pole vault, catapulting, very dangerous and very low probability, high failure type of a strategy. I don't recommend that. I want you to realize that if you can make everything you're doing improved by 3% here, 4% here, 7% there, and at the same time, you can add 10 better ways or additional ways, and each one brings 3, 5, 15% greater yield, and maybe occasionally you have a windfall and you get a 50% or a double, the cumulative effect of all that will be in the hundreds of percent improvement. Does that make sense to you, or am I being too abstract?
No, I think it makes excellent sense. I'm getting kind of hungry to figure out how to do this.
Okay, well, no, but you can't do that until you first of all recognize those factors. I can't take you to where you want to be. Then you go through the 3 ways to grow your business model, and you ask yourself this question. Number one, you go through the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 primary ways you can grow your customers, and you're looking at 2 different issues when you review it. Number one, which of these am I already doing? And number two, which of these should I be doing? And then you have one other factor. Which of these that I should be doing require less effort and have higher yield potential than what I'm already doing and should be replacing what I'm doing?
Okay.
So go through them again. Let's look at the options. Am I doing referral systems? Yes or no? If so, how many referral systems am I using? If not, should I be using referral systems? And the answer to the question is resolved by looking at the goodwill you already have established with your customer and the natural occurrence of referrals, whether you're formally looking for them, asking for them, or going after them or not. If your business is growing and 20 to 30% of that growth comes from referrals that just sort of stumble in without any formal process in place, you ought to have a formal referral system in action. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes sense.
Okay, next thing. Am I acquiring customers at a break even and making money on the back end, or should I be? If I'm not, should I be doing it? If I should be doing it, what's the best approach to take? And you got to realize my options. Number one, I can sell my product for less money initially if there's a high repeat factor to the customer. Number two, I can take the profit on the sale, and instead of retaining it, I can use it to purchase more bonus materials I can add to the sale. Number three, I can offer a larger commission to the salesperson for making a brand new sale because I know I'm going to get far more repurchases out of that customer. And I can go on and on. Next question is, how am I guaranteeing the purchase or risk reversing the transaction now versus how many better or more powerful ways could I do it? Knowing that you stand behind the sale if there's a problem but not verbalizing it is the most pathetic form of risk reversal.
Mm-hmm.
Saying money back guaranteed is a nominal form of risk reversal. 30-day no questions asked money back guarantee is a better one. 60-day no questions asked is an even better one. Better than money back guarantee is an even better one, where you give them something even if they ask for a refund to reward them for their risk, their time, their faith, and their effort. Specifically denominating what satisfaction should look like, meaning unless you get such and such a result in such a time period and can absolutely say that such and such a thing happens by such and such a date, I won't keep your money. I don't deserve to, is about 10 times more effective. So the question is, do you even use risk reversal now? Is the risk reversal you're using the one that you should be? So I'm going to go through all these, and we're going to talk about a hierarchy. The next thing is advertising. Are you advertising? If so, are you using the advertising in the best manner possible? Are you following the advertising formula that I would have shared in a previous issue? If not, why? If so, is it working? Because advertising is normally the least viable of all the approaches you have in the growth formula, because most people use advertising ineffectively. They don't use it in vertical publications and targeted niche publications. They use it in the general market publications, and they're paying a premium for all the readers or subscribers when only a fraction of a fraction are the ones that really have value to them. Next, you know, do I have continuous special events and information nights for my customers, or the equivalent? The equivalent means if you sell by mail or by telephone, do you have other kinds of special information offers that get people attracted to you? Seminars by phone, reports you send out, tapes you send out, videos you send out, things you do at other people's locations around the country, around your market. Do you have a qualified list of high-priority prospects that you work, that you concentrate most of your time on, or are you just calling cold anybody? If you have prospects, have you evaluated them so that the bulk of your time or the time of your salespeople or your telephone people or your customer-generating people are being concentrated on only those categories that have the highest probability of converting? Many people have a very, very pathetic and ill-conceived method of prospecting for customers, and 90% of the time people spend is being dissipated on activities and areas of people or businesses that have virtually no probability of ever becoming a customer. Who stands to be the best probable customer? Who stands not to be? Are you spending your time on the best or the worst, or don't even know? You got to have these questions answered first. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Let me continue.